The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
For Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. It's our pre-Halloween show, and we try not to scare you with too much of the spooktacular happenings here in Washington, D.C., where it's hard not to be depressed by either the rain or the lack of congressional action on so many critical issues for us as citizens. We're going to talk, we got a very interesting show today. We're going to kick things off with one of the areas where we do see a ray of sunshine, and that is the potential in the transportation and infrastructure world for some changes. And our host is someone who's been on the show a couple times with us. That's Bob Burleson, the president of the Florida Transportation Builders Association. Bob, it's rainy and gloomy here. Please tell me that in Florida it's sunny and beautiful.
It's sunny and 83 degrees right now, Kevin, where I am. A beautiful day.
You're probably calling me from the 12th fairway then, and we do appreciate you taking time out from the fairway to call in and talk to us. Bob, want to talk about a lot of things going on in the transportation and infrastructure world, and we'll start with the president, who's got a jobs bill that has gone down to ignominious defeat in both chambers of Congress in the last 60 days, and now he's trying to chop it up piece by piece. And I want to ask you to talk about, from the road builder's perspective, the transportation sector's perspective, how does this jobs bill compare to the Recovery Act, the Stimulus One, if you will, from 2 years ago?
Well, Kevin, it's interesting. The jobs bill is almost identical from a transportation perspective to the president's stimulus bill. There's an equal amount of funding, roughly $27.5 billion proposed. The problem that we in the road building industry had, not that we weren't very grateful for the additional funding that came our way with the stimulus package, but the problem was that a lot of people in Congress felt like they had dealt with the infrastructure issue when the president's stimulus package passed. The highway bill, which expired over 2 years ago, was kind of put on hold. The can was kicked down the road, so to speak. And a lot of states actually reduced their spending and simply used the stimulus money to maintain a status quo in where their programs were. So certainly we were grateful to have the money, but it probably protected jobs. I'm not sure that it added any new jobs. Now, I love to debate the topic that, you know, if I'm going to lay somebody off next week, that's really no different if I keep his job than if I added a new job.
I see. That's interesting. Well, tell me, Bob, I spent some time on the phone yesterday, part of a transportation industry conference call, listening to Senator Barbara Boxer, who's the chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee, which has jurisdiction over a lot of these issues. She seems to think that we've got a window of opportunity to get a long-term surface transportation bill passed in Congress. Tell me a little bit about where you see things, where they stand on the highway bill.
Well, I'm certainly glad to hear that that's Senator Boxer's perspective, and I share that. And I think that her counterpart in the House, John Micah, who is a Floridian, as you know, certainly wants a long-term highway bill, and he wants one fairly quickly. I think the positive thing that that I've seen evolve over the last few weeks is that the Republicans seem to view the highway bill as an alternative to the president's jobs program. In other words, if there's an area that the Republicans see with an opportunity to generate some jobs, it's the highway bill. And it seems to me that Speaker Boehner has given the go-ahead to Chairman Mica to look for some funding. You know, I don't know under what rock they might have it hidden up there.
They're looking in the seat cushions. I know that.
They seem to be able to find money when they really want to. And we certainly would like to see enough money that I know the Senate's position has long been that we can't have a reduction in the program. That certainly is our position. Mr. Micah's position has been that he wants to spend the money that's available. He doesn't want a reduction, but he's bound by what money is available to be spent. But he definitely wants a long-term bill, a six-year bill. So I think the outlook is much more positive than it was, say, 2 months ago.
Well, before we get into what you want, Bob, I'd like you to sort of walk us through what are the challenges. We've been a couple of years now trying to get a long-term reauthorization passed. What are the problems inherent in this sector of the economy by not having a long-term plan for federal spending?
Well, the biggest problem it creates, Kevin, is that state DOTs cannot plan their work programs. All states have a work program that goes out at least 5 years, and that work program is predicated on funding that will come in from their state and from the federal dollars that each state receives. And if you don't know how much money you're getting from the federal government, it's difficult to plan, and consequently you underplan. And when you underplan, then if money does become available, you're in a catch-up mode where you don't have plans on the shelf ready to go. You know, the term that was coined, which really has killed us in the industry, I wish I knew who came up with it, shovel-ready projects. Highway projects are, you don't turn the switch and start them tomorrow. They take a little while to get going unless you're just repaving a road. But they do produce long-term benefit and long-term jobs.
I'm pretty sure whoever came up with the term shovel-ready is currently working on a press gang and a road project above the Arctic Circle.
Well, it did us no favors, I can tell you that.
Yeah, the Obama administration has probably exiled that person to a most disfavorable posting. Well, tell me, Bob, let's talk a little bit about what the road builders want. I mean, obviously, service transportation bill, you've got highway funding, you've got transit funding, you've got safety program funding, and a few other random things in there, some research and whatnot. What's on the wish list for, you know, Florida transportation builders, but also builders in general for this bill?
Kevin, I think certainly for most people in our side of the industry, we see a lot that we like in Chairman Micah's drafts that he's tossed out. Where he likes to eliminate a lot of the, I'll call them fringe programs, and get back to the basics of building and improving the major highways, the interstates, federal highways. It's not that we're against bike paths, trails, rails to trails, that sort of thing. Remodeling old train stations. But, you know, I think a lot of those type things, at least from a federal perspective, have given us a bad eye. People tend to think that that's money that's maybe wasted from their gas tax dollars. A lot of those things, to me, are local decisions. You know, if our locality here in Tallahassee, Florida, wants to do bike trails or sidewalks, I'm all for that. But I think it should be a local decision, and that the federal dollars should go where they're most needed, which is to improve the main structure of the roadways. So that, reducing the timeline from an environmental regulation standpoint, not reducing our responsibility to the environment, but just reducing the timeline and the seemingly repetitive steps you have to go through to get projects approved.
Well, Bob, it's trick-or-treating next week, and the trick with the highway bill, or potentially the treat, is how do you pay for it? As you know, we've reached a point in the process where the Highway Trust Fund no longer takes in the revenue needed to meet the projections for spending at current levels. I saw something that vehicle miles traveled is now at its lowest point in about a decade. And, expected to continue to fall. So where do you think the folks should find the money to finance our needs to build up this infrastructure over the next 5 or 6 years?
Well, Kevin, you're right. Vehicle miles traveled is declining. But bigger than that is the fact that vehicles are getting better gas mileage. So we've got to come up with an alternative way to fund. Short term, I think we still have to look towards a gas tax, or I think the House is looking towards some alternative fuel taxes or taxes related to new drilling opportunities, certainly, which makes sense to me. I mean, if we want to be energy independent, we better be seeking out some new sources of oil here in the United States, and we've got them. We just need to go after them, and if we can figure out a way to generate some revenue off that, I think that's very positive. I think long-term, taxing, getting rid of the gas tax completely and taxing people based on miles traveled is the way we'll go, so that we're back to the true user fee.
Bob, give me your worst-case scenario. This bill's scheduled to expire March 31st. What happens if we don't have a long-term reauthorization bill in place as we enter the 2012 building season? I know it's always building season in Florida, but up north, that building season's a fairly short one.
Well, the worst-case scenario, Kevin, I think, is that we'll just continue to work on extensions of the existing bill. In other words, we'll just keep kicking the can down the road like we do with so many things in Washington. And what that does is it keeps us working short term, but it stops DOTs all over the country from working, getting those longer term, more involved projects, putting plans on paper and getting projects ready to go, so that in a year or 2 years from now, we've got work to go to. I don't think Congress would let the bill expire without, operating on a continuation. But worst case scenario is we would get another continuation the end of March.
Very good. Well, we've been joined by Bob Burleson, the president of the Florida Transportation Builders Association, seeing a few rays of sunshine, perhaps in what's been a long slog towards getting a surface transportation reauthorization bill moving through Congress. Bob, you enjoy your time down there in Tallahassee, where it's warm and beautiful while we're cold and dreary in Washington. We will have you back on the show as we continue to see the transportation bill move a little bit closer to the finish line. We'll be back with more Capital Thinking right after this commercial break.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. Tune in to the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs. Straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back. Well, we're going to shift gears a little bit now and take you into the tax world. Joining us for this segment is our resident tax guru, George Schutzer, a partner of mine at Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C., where he focuses his attention on helping business and nonprofit clients on tax matters in a variety of contexts. And George is here today to follow up on some of the things that we talked about last week in the energy sector and basically how folks who are seeking federal government help can make sure that in receiving that assistance, they don't fall into some traps that lead them to be audited by the IRS or have other punitive action taken against them. So, George, welcome back to the show. And let me kick it off by starting to talk to you about last week. We had somebody on that talked a little bit about this blossoming Solyndra scandal where you've got hundreds of millions of dollars in federal loans. And I know the Treasury Department's got an inspector general who's auditing the grant, and I believe this program's called the Section 1603 program. Tell us a little bit about the program and what it has the auditors so interested in this situation.
The Section 1603 program, Kevin, is an opportunity for taxpayers to receive a grant from the government in lieu of a tax credit. The tax credit regime is often unsuccessful in incentivizing investment in energy, in part because the tax credits can't be used because of a variety of limitations, most important of which is just one has to have sufficient income tax liability to use a credit. So in lieu of the credit, though following income tax principles, Treasury is providing grants generally of 30% of the eligible basis of property. Since they're grants and since they're made by the Treasury Department, the Inspector General has been doing what may be random audits to determine whether there are issues and whether there are abuses. There are five audit reports posted on Treasury's website relating to the 1603 program. And interestingly, in four out of the five, the issues that the Inspector General identified were relatively minimal relative to the size of the project. In one case, the Inspector General questioned about 0.2% of the eligible costs. Another case, about 0.7% of the eligible costs. Another one was also in the low range, but they got the law wrong and ultimately concluded that everything that was claimed for a $406 million project was fine. In a fourth case, they questioned about 0.25% of the total. And in each of those cases, after some discussions with the claimants, they've backed off on some of their alleged discrepancies to even reduce to a smaller amount, the unresolved amount. The largest claim or issue was 3%, and that was involved a transaction between related parties.
Well, George, let me jump back in here. So I know you've been talking about this in the context of Treasury and their Inspector General, but you are talking about tax law. And, you know, anytime I think of tax trouble, I think of three ugly letters, IRS. So where's the IRS sort of out here stalking things on this program?
We think it's possible that the IRS may also do some auditing. The IRS put out a statement regarding the tax consequences of a determination that a company claimed a grant that was too large. And the document the IRS puts out says if you claim a grant that was too large, the IRS will view the amount that's too big as receipt of income in the year the grant was received, and will allow an offsetting deduction in the year the amount is paid back to Treasury. What one could infer from that was that the IRS thought it had the right to take an independent look at claims for grants to see if the amount claimed was legitimate. The document doesn't affirmatively say that the IRS has got any authority to require the excess amount to be paid back to Treasury. But I would imagine that it would report anything that it found to its sister agency, and then the Treasury could come knocking on the door to make a claim. So in one sense, these projects are potentially subject to double audits, one, a random audit by the Inspector General, and then possibly a second audit by the IRS.
I see. Well, so tell me, I mean, I got to think that the punishment has to just begin at the point of repaying what the feds might have invested in your energy loan through this program. But surely if you've through incompetence or malfeasance had some bad things go wrong here, you're talking about a lot more than just repaying the loan, right?
It's hard to tell. I would say if there were fraud or criminal conduct in connection with seeking a grant for which a party was not eligible for and knew the party was not eligible for, there could be greater consequences. There is an added protection, I think, both for the government and possibly for the claimants here, in that when one submits a claim for a grant in excess of $500,000 or for property with a basis of an excess of $500,000, an accountant's certification as to the costs need to be provided. So you've got an independent accountant who is forced to take a look at the claim and back it up, provide support for the claim. So it may be a little bit harder than in some cases to make a fraudulent claim. I would argue it would be easier to fraudulently claim a 30% investment credit on a tax return than it would be to claim fraudulently the same 30% grant.
Interesting. All right, so George, let's get practical. Talk to me about the people who are already out there applying for a grant. What's your advice on what to do now to limit your exposure and to make sure that you have the documentation that you're doing the right things?
The Treasury, in one of its guidance documents, has indicated that there are two areas that it's particularly concerned about. One is a transaction with a related party, because in a transaction with a related party, there is an ability to push up the price because the dollars are going from right hand to left hand, and if moving dollars from right hand to left hand can increase the amount of credit, there's certainly an incentive to do that. So to the extent that a claimant is making payments to a related party that might be included in basis, the claimant should be careful to make sure that they can justify that the amounts being paid are reasonable, reflect fair market value, and are in accordance with custom and practice. The second place that the Treasury is focusing on is in a situation where the claimant is purchasing or acquiring multiple pieces of property or services from another party, and that there is an ability to allocate the total purchase price or total compensation among many things, some of which may be eligible and some of which may not be eligible. And again, there the advice would be to be careful, make sure that the allocations are sustainable, that they're consistent with practice, and probably best off to have separate contracts that cover eligible costs from those that cover ineligible costs. Where I've actually seen the bigger problems are not in the actual submission to the Treasury, but in folks who were out marketing deals in midstream for another party to buy, take over, and claim the grant on. And I've seen some claims by the sellers or their agents about levels of grants that may go beyond what's really sustainable. And often that comes from suggestions that we may be able to structure the overall payments in a way that you're paying more for eligible property and less for things that are highly important. You'll see deals where there's a power purchase agreement in place and the permitting done to allow a facility to be built. And those are actually very high value assets because it means you can go ahead and build the facility and then move ahead. And yet sometimes you'll see suggestions of, well, pay us sort of a reduced price for that and pay us a developer fee for helping build the wind facility or the solar facility. And those are the kinds of things that one might agree to when purchasing a facility, and then when you go to get the accountant certificate, the accountant said, no way am I going to certify to those sorts of inflated costs. I know the Treasury will pick them up, and it's wrong and against my professional responsibility to do that.
George, you got about a minute left. I know legislation isn't always your preferred area, but tell me this. Do the problems signaled by the IG getting involved at Treasury here signal you in some way that maybe this grant program might not get reauthorized in the future?
I don't think so. I think once looked at objectively, the IG reports would tell me that there is fairly substantial compliance. And if one looks at the risk areas, the risks that occur with respect to the credit. So I think the fundamental question here will be, does Congress want to continue to invest in subsidizing the renewable energy sector? And if so, does it want to continue to do it in the most efficient way, which is allowing for grants rather than putting folks in a position where they need to come up with complex business transactions to try to monetize the value of tax credits that they cannot use.
Very good. Well, we're going to cut it off there. We've been joined by George Schutzer from Patton Boggs talking about energy grants and how to avoid audit pitfalls. We'll be back in just a minute after this commercial break here on Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On CIO Talk Radio, we talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its risks. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, Sunjo Gall interviews business leaders and other experts that are shaping the way we use technology. To learn more about the show, visit www.ciotalkradio.com. Keep up with the changing world of technology and listen to CIO Talk Radio with Sunjo Gall. Listen in every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Central, 7 a.m. Pacific, right here on Voice America Business.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. I laugh as we come out of this commercial break because they're saying in the bumper there, email, and while we're sitting here, I'm getting very funny emails about what I should be talking about, what's going on that fires people up in Washington. I've got an email that comes in that says, chew on this in the last 15 minutes, and then goes on to describe this person's current concerns about what fires them up with what the president and Congress are doing wrong. And we try and get to those. I'm not sure we'll get to those today, but do appreciate folks who fire those emails in with what they're interested in. Sometimes you're very serious, and sometimes your thoughts are great and amusing at the same time. But we got a great segment here that we're going to spend much of the rest of the show talking about. We have one of my favorite colleagues from Patton Boggs, John Oberdorfer, who is a very senior litigator with a lot of experience in the international litigation area and also in the world of complex alternative dispute resolution. And we're going to spend some time today delving into how to plan for dispute resolution and how to effectively handle disputes to avoid litigation. John was featured in a recent news article on this topic, and we wanted to kind of cover some of that ground with him. So, John, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I hope you're doing well and staying out of the rain today.
Absolutely, Kevin. It's always a pleasure to be on this show with you and to participate and with your great audience. Thank you so much for inviting me again.
Well, good. Well, let's start. I want to start in the commercial contracts world. I know you spend some time there, and kind of give us the lay of the land of what's going on with arbitration now. Is that becoming a more preferred forum for dispute resolution, and how does that matter in the international context? With so many people being international companies now, is there a difference? Is there some preference for a foreign company to want to go to arbitration as opposed to be subject to the jurisdiction of United States courts or vice versa?
Kevin, I was thinking about this show in the last few minutes. It struck me that there's sort of a bizarre aspect, perhaps a commentary on our society, that we really are a litigious society, not only in the United States but elsewhere, and that perhaps the topic of arbitration really takes it to its pinnacle, because we're talking about companies or people who enter into business transactions, want to do a deal. They write it down carefully what they're going to do. They have every intention and good faith of going forward and doing what they're both trying to do together. And the last thing they do is they write in an arbitration clause, which is supposed to address what happens when it goes off the road or one party is unable to fulfill its obligations. And it's sort of, you know, planning for the demise of the deal that you're doing is sort of a strange way to be doing business, but it is an absolute necessity.
It's like the prenuptial agreement, John. My wife and I have one that's mocking humor that a lawyer friend drew up for 16 and a half years ago, but every once in a while she pulls it out and threatens me with a couple provisions in it. Isn't that the same sort of thing?
Yes.
Preparing for worst-case
yes,
scenario?
It, it really is. I guess that maybe it's more or less complex, but we are talking about commercial transactions, business transactions, and that, arbitration has always been something that businesses and people have said they prefer over the courts. I think it's become increasingly true. Every survey you read, every inquiry you make says that businesses in particular those engaged in businesses in a country other than their own, look for arbitration as a way to resolve disputes. And the question is how carefully do they look at that before they go into it, and what do they weigh? Do they weigh enough of the factors? Do they provide enough? And when the, I guess the inevitable happens, are they prepared for it? Have they set the stage?
So you really do see a difference between these disputes taking place in an international context versus here in the United States court system?
I think there's a difference. I think that a lot of businesses will opt for, in sort of a knee-jerk way, for arbitration. They'll put in a clause at the end of a very simple contract that says, in the event of dispute, this will be arbitrated under the auspices of the American Arbitration Association. And that's all as far as they go in thinking about what might happen. And they do that for a number of reasons. One is they think that arbitration, and I'm talking within the United States, is cheaper and faster than going to court. They may want to protect the dispute from publicity, access of the press or others to public records would be in court, and they think that they can avoid a jury. That for a business, a jury is something to be avoided at all costs. And so, in a U.S. domestic commercial dispute, there's a lot of movement to arbitration for that reason. Some of that is certainly true, and some of that is compelling. But there are other factors to consider. For instance, if you file in arbitration, you have to pay an arbitration fee and you have to pay the cost of the arbitrators. If you file a dispute in a state or federal court, you pay a nominal filing fee and you don't pay the judge. You don't pay any more for the judicial process at all. That's all public service. There are many courts which are able to handle commercial disputes very well, have magistrates and others who are superb at settlement. To me, it's a closer call for disputes within the United States than it is once you move internationally.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that internationally. I mean, surely, Guy, with you, you got a long track record, some great wins under your belt. You must have a philosophy about how you would advise a client to negotiate these dispute clauses in a complex international contract. So why don't you give us some of the key elements of what your advising philosophy is in those instances?
Okay, let me just first of all tell you why I think a business or company ought to be going in that direction, and that is because primarily it has to do with the enforcement of a judgment, it is much more easy to enforce a judgment through an arbitration, through an international arbitration, than it is from a court in one of the 100 plus countries around the world. And this is because something called the New York Convention, which virtually every country recognizes and will enforce an arbitration judgment under. So that's a very important motivation to be engaging in arbitration if you're in an international circumstance. Other considerations are concerns in many countries about the nature of the local and national judiciary, and particularly if you are the outsider coming in, if you're the investor, if you're the contractor, you're going, you're going to have a dispute on somebody else's home court. You want to neutralize that as much as possible. So, we found in looking at the behavior of companies that, a very, very high percentage do prefer international arbitration for disputes, and have found it to be relatively successful. As to your specific question, what would I advise about negotiating dispute clauses? The core of my advice is that a dispute clause is just as important a business term as any other business term, and that the tendency is to treat it as a technical legalistic part of a contract, and leave it to the lawyers, tell them to decide on whatever they think best. But my advice is, this is something that the business principal really needs to focus on and needs to sort of walk through what the pros and cons are of setting it up in various ways. That it's not enough to just put in a sentence that says, to be arbitrated under XYZ institution. There's much more to be thought through, and that is one of the failings in many, many disputes, is that when people are surveyed afterwards, as Price Waterhouse and St. Mary's College in London have done, they find that many companies have come to the dispute stage not prepared. They're not unprepared because of something along the way. They're unprepared because when they were negotiating the contract, they didn't pay enough attention to the dispute clause, and there they are. They have signed on. Remember that an arbitration clause in a contract is a voluntary provision. It takes two to tango here, and if the two don't agree, then on the arbitration clause, then it doesn't go in. So once it is in, those decision makers on the outside, view that as you knew what you were doing, and this is what you meant to do, and this is how you mean to have it resolved, and every word, every concept becomes very critical. So that is very, very important in terms of achieving a favorable result if you are in a dispute situation. And there are critical points there. The first question is,
John, let me cut you off there. I'm going to have a commercial dispute with the network here.
Okay.
If I don't break for some advertising here, we're going to come back in just a minute with John Orberdorfer, talk some more about dispute resolution in international commercial contracts right after this on Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Edward Newberry, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we are continuing our discussions from the before the break with John Oberdorfer, who's a great litigator and a colleague, partner of mine at Patton & Boggs. We're talking with John a little bit about the importance of planning for dispute resolution in international commercial contract situations. And, John, I think I cut you off at the break there. You were about to start to maybe describe to us some of the factors that these parties in the contractual dispute should be factoring into, should be considering, I should say, in their putting together a dispute resolution model beforehand, right? Is that where you were?
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, the first thing to think about is, there are a number of forums available. They're all private, that you have to choose and, designate. You pay a fee to have their auspices around you. They're the most well-known ones are in Paris and London and then the American Arbitration Association here. But there are a number of regional ones around the world, and those are becoming increasingly more important. And so there's a choice to be made there. Obviously, there's a trade-off. The home company is going to want to use the local one, and you may want to use one in London or Paris, and so there's some way you have to work to get a compromise on that. Certainly the factors to take into account are the nature of the local law, where you're going to situate the arbitration. Do local courts interfere with arbitrations? Do they let them go? Do they enforce them? Those kinds of questions. And then if you're dealing with a company that has got a lot of people on the ground, or the people who are knowledgeable about the matter or on the ground in a particular location, how do you have an arbitration go forward, have them participate, but not disrupt, their otherwise productive contributions to their company, so that you don't remove them from the office or even from the country for extended periods of time. That's a very pragmatic consideration that I don't think very many people think about. There are questions about do you mimic the U.S. Discovery process? Do you put in some sort of variation of it into the arbitration? Do you give the arbitrators the ability to exact some sort of interim relief, such as what we're familiar with, a preliminary injunction or something to stop something from happening while the dispute is resolved? There are a whole list of questions like that, Kevin, that you need to think through. And I've been speaking in terms of if there's a dispute between you and me and we're parties to a contract, But oftentimes there are more than just two parties to a contract, and there are many, many contracts pertaining to a particular project that begin to overlap and need to be reconciled. And if you're speaking of a large infrastructure project or something like that, then there's going to be the whole panoply of these multiple contracts, multiple parties to think about how you're going to get them under an arbitration tent, because they can't be compelled. They'll only be there by consent. And how do you do that? So the larger the project, the more complex the project, the more difficult achieving a full single arbitral resolution becomes.
John, we've talked a lot on this show earlier this year without you about sort of emerging issues from the Arab Spring, and I know you've spent some time abroad at the Pattenbaugh's offices over in the Arabian Gulf. Tell us a little bit about the development of arbitration as an institution in the Middle East.
Well, it's very interesting because it was not very extant until recently. Perhaps recently means during the last 6 or 8 or 10 years of when the economy has gone in a southerly direction, and investments and things in the Middle East and by interest in the Middle East were encountering problems. Before that, I think that there was a lot of reliance on just working things out, more of an informal mediation, if you will. But now there are institutions being that have been created and are developing in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Doha, and they are becoming more and more sophisticated. At the same time that those nation states are working to put their national laws and court system in a structure that's compatible with arbitration, because I think they recognize that attracting investment, particularly large investment, is somewhat dependent on having a good dispute resolution system that people from outside the Gulf are comfortable with, as they would be in Paris and London.
All right, very good. Well, let me talk a little bit about large construction projects. Are there particular twists, maybe even if you're looking at, obviously, over in the Gulf, they build so many things so quickly, the biggest and the best of everything. How does that impact in resolving disputes without shutting a project down?
Well, I think that's been the challenge, they have tried to institute in the process various kinds of adjudication boards, either dispute resolution board or dispute adjudication board, which would be a standing board, sort of like a standing arbitration panel of experts who are expert on construction or on costing or whatever the key issues are, who are there on sort of a standby basis and follow the progress of the case of the project. They will meet informally, trying to encourage dispute avoidance, and if that's not possible, then assist in its resolution. And they can be quasi formal, sort of mixing a mediation arbitration element in, or they can be full arbitration. But the point is to have a dispute resolution entity on the ground there, available, familiar with the project, doesn't need to be educated every time there's a dispute, and can hopefully make most of the disputes go away through discussion, but be expert and credible and competent enough to deal with the ones that really do require a third party to decide and put to bed.
John, I got time for one more question here, about 90 seconds left. Tell me about the battle of the expert witnesses. I know that that's usually what some of these things can hinge on in the United States court system. Is the same true in the arbitration process, both here and abroad?
Yes, the same is true in a different way. I think that there is more, and I'm thinking particularly in the construction context, more of a willingness to hear what the expert across the table is saying, rather than considering him or her just another witness that needs to be cross-examined, that there's a role that these people can play in providing sort of a bellwether on somebody's claim or contention by doing a really thorough job digging through it and coming up with their expert view, and being less of a hired gun and more of a an expert in the field who's rendering an opinion. So that can contribute significantly to this process I've been talking about.
John, I'm going to have to cut you off there. We'll have to have you back maybe to continue this discussion at a later date. But that's going to wrap things up for this week's Capital Thinking. Hope everyone has a safe trick-or-treating experience. Happy Halloween. We'll be back next Thursday with more Capital Thinking.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.